Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio collector, historian, Ed Corcoran. Ed, we have an author tonight.
Yes, a very famous author who is a best-selling author, and we'll find that his radio background really provided the nucleus for that success he enjoyed in later life.
We're talking, of course, about Sam Sinclair Baker, who has written well over 20 books, 23 books, and I think that Sam, number 24, is already in the oven.
Right.
But prior to your tremendous success as an author, you were in radio as a writer, and that's what we're going to explore tonight. How did you ever get started in radio?
I was in advertising. I came to New York deep in the Depression to be a newspaper man or magazine writer, whatnot. The only job I could get, and that was lucky, was as an office boy in an advertising agency. And I worked in a one-man advertising agency for years, learned all the ropes, and I was on that job for 7 years, and I wanted to move to a bigger agency. And an agency came along. I answered an ad with a telegram.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the fact it was a telegram got a response. The man who ran the agency was H.M. Keyswetter, was the name of the agency. That's significant and something I'll mention later. And he talked to me and he hired me. And he said, how much notice do you have to give? And I said, well, I better give him a month because I did so many things at the agency. And he said, okay, come here in a month and you've got a job. And I said, I don't like to come into a place cold. Isn't there anything I can do in the meantime? He said, well, we have a show on the air. It's called Famous Jury Trials.
Mm-hmm.
For the Menon Company. That was the sponsor. And he said, we're having writer trouble, and maybe you'd like to fool around with writing one of these. And he handed me 10 pieces of paper, which were a trial written up by a lawyer, Martin Young, who did the background material on these. It was his idea, his show. So I took that home, and nights I'd work on it, and I came in on a Monday morning and said hello, and he'd forgotten he'd given me this. And he called me in, and he said, we're having a terrible meeting here because we have to have a script for Famous Jury Trials for tonight, and the script we have is just lousy. So I pulled out my briefcase, and I said, I happen to have a script. And he looked at it, he said, sit down, and two guys stood behind him, and they flipped through it, and they looked up at me in amazement and said, this is perfect, we'll go. So from then on, in addition to my agency work, I wrote Famous Jury Trials every week for about 2 years.
That's a great way to get started, to get your feet wet.
Yeah, and so many people say, I want to write for radio today. I guess they say, I want to write for television, too. And the way to do it is to write. You know, I had been listening to radio scripts. You know, a terrible thing about radio, after a while I was, about radio writers, I should say, after a while I was involved in some soap operas and so forth. I can't even remember the names of them, but people would come in, young people, and say, I want to write for Maggie's Dilemma or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, good, let me see a script. And they'd say, oh, I've never written anything on it. I said, well, what do you think of the show? And they'd say, oh, I never listened to it. I don't listen to soap operas. And they want to write. And so, of course, they never became writers. So
no, obviously.
Well, I think Famous Jury Trials was a little tough because some trials could last weeks or months, and yet you had to crystallize it into a half hour. So it must have taken a lot of reading and research to know where to cut and what to highlight.
Yes,
and, so forth.
And of course, one of the wonderful things about radio is that in a drama like that, you leave so much to the person's imagination. And you can recreate a whole courtroom. You can bring in all kinds of scenes. You don't have to have anybody looking over your shoulder and saying, well, we can't do that on TV because it'll cost $10,000 to have that chase through the highways. You could make up all this and use the listener's imagination. And we had wonderful actors then, chatting before, Betty Gard and so forth. I mentioned that Betty Gard was our best crier. You know, she'd get on and she'd have to cry, and Betty, on an instant's notice, you don't send my boy to the electric chair, and all this weeping and whatnot. The great names that came out of that, Van Heflin started on Famous Jury Trials as a court crier. All he had to do for the half hour was, hear ye, his honor the judge is entering the courtroom. And then gradually got better parts, and he was always a wonderful guy. He'd come slouching into the studio the way that he acted in the movies. Those were thrilling times, and many of the greatest stars today came from those, as you know better than I do.
Well, I'm just trying to pinpoint what era we're talking about. Late 30s now? Early 40s?
Yes.
Somewhere in there?
Yeah. Late 30s, early 40s. Mm-hmm. That's just what it was.
Did you ever get involved at all in comedy, or did you stay strictly with the dramatic shows? Did you seek to broaden your horizon at all?
Yeah, or? One of my greatest thrills was in radio and in show business altogether. You make very close friends after a while. And Roger Bauer, who I understand you've had on this show, director, then he went on to Can You Top This, was the director of the Famous Jury Trial shows. And Roger and his wife and we became close friends. And then along the way, we did a show called Colonel Stoopnagel's Quixie Doodle Program. And I think many people remember Colonel Lemuel Q. Stoopnagel because he did all these crazy inventions. One of them was Colonel Stoopnagel's special rubber ceilings. Indispensable for people who get very unhappy every time they think of election returns, and they get so inflamed they hit the ceiling. But you don't fracture your skull because the ceiling is made of rubber. And he was the predecessor of all this zany humor. And you wonder how it comes. In his case, it came out of his head. He had this vague kind of thing, watching the elevators before in your lobby. Incidentally, this is a beautiful building. I watch the elevators going up and then they come down and all. And I remember once Stoop and I, he came and picked me up for lunch. And we went out to the lobby and waited for an elevator to take us down from the 10th floor. This is the kind of humor that he had. And there were glass doors and we saw an elevator go up. There was a bank of three elevators and another elevator go up and we kept ringing the bell. Another elevator went up. Kept ringing the bell, nothing happened, and Stoop turned to me and he said, oh, I see, they go up and over.
Who was Colonel Stoopnagel?
Colonel Stoopnagel was a fine gentleman named F. Chase Taylor, and a very quiet man, a plump, sweet. I never heard Stoop say a single expletive, but he had this crazy way. Some of the people remember that... He invented the 20-foot pole so that you it would help you not to touch two people with a 10-foot pole. All that kind of thing.
I remember the automobile he invented during the war with the large rubber tires on the back so that it was continually going downhill and saved a lot of gas that way.
And one that I wish we had today, that's a backward stamp. He said, if you forgot to write to somebody last week, you just write the letter, put the backward stamp on, and they receive it last week.
Time machine.
Some of the postal service that we get today works in a similar fashion.
This is particularly good for radio because the people can picture this. Now, when television came in, he tried some of his humor on TV, and it just didn't work because he tried dragging in a 20-foot pole. And they say, what's this for? And it's for not touching people twice with a 10-foot pole. Well, it's just not as good as seeing it in your mind.
You know, I recall when Bye Bye Birdie was produced on Broadway. Did you see that show by any chance?
No, I didn't.
Well, the reason I'm talking about it is there's
No, we got somebody out of that show to do commercials. who became a star, Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke. Sure, yeah. Sure. But the point is that the mother-in-law in the show was always talking about putting her head in the oven and turning on the gas. You see, but she never did it. I mean, she just talked about it, and it was very funny. Now, in the movie, she actually did it, and it was embarrassing because there's nothing funny about it visually.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Well, we've been talking about Colonel Stupnagel, and I wish we could hear an excerpt from that marvelous program, but unfortunately they are so rare that they don't exist, at least in your collection, Ed. So how about a Vic and Say? Let's go back and really bring out a classic.
Well, sir, the evening meal has been over only a little while as we approach the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here on the front porch, we find Mr. Victor Gook all by himself. Vic is swinging gently in the swing and leafing languidly through the newspaper. And at this moment, the screen door opens. Listen.
Oh, out here, are you?
You hit the nail right on the head, Dr. Sleech. I'm out here.
Oh, I didn't know but what you'd skipped over to knee suffers.
Nope.
Say, it's getting cooler.
Yeah.
There's a kind of halfway smell of rain in the air.
Paper states rain for tonight.
All right, then, move over.
Oh, I'm always moving over. Seems like I spend half my time moving over. Fella gets sick and tired of it.
Why'd we ever buy such a skimpy, rotten little porch swing in the first place? Only two people can sit comfortable in it. We might have at least remembered there's three in the family.
Where's the rest of the family, by the way?
The rest of the family pulled off a swindle, I think.
Huh?
He and I were doing the dishes, me washing, him wiping. Bluetooth Johnson come up on the back porch and pushed his nose against the screen. Good evening, Miss Gook, he says. Rush, can I see you on a matter of the utmost importance? Well, Rush tossed his dish towel on the sink and says, I'm sure you'll excuse me, Mom.
He went away and never come back.
Exactly. I had to finish the dishes and clean the kitchen all by myself.
That man is a sly operator.
I'll sly operator him.
When he comes back, remind me to thrash him within an inch of his life. The indignities we've suffered at that rascal's
head. Good evening.
Who's that?
Sitting over on Elder's porch.
Yeah, I see the guy, but who is he?
Miss Elder's father. He's here on a visit from Dismal Seepage, Ohio.
Well, why does he sit that way? His legs hanging over the end of the porch swing.
Haven't the slightest notion.
Seems to me
that he's an eccentric fella. He was a teacher before he retired. I met him this afternoon. Very pleasant old gentleman.
Mm.
You know what Miss Elders calls him?
Ralph.
Instead of Papa or Dad or Father, she calls him Professor. Professor, can't I bring you a cushion to sit on? Professor, there's a plate of solid peanuts in on the buffet. And when she's talking about him, she refers to him as the Professor.
Hmm.
The Professor likes his eggs over easy at breakfast. The Professor can't stand to ride the train backwards.
Well, what's the idea?
Miss Elders is so proud he's a teacher, I guess.
Hmm.
Well, I guess it is going to rain. Lightning way over there. Say, speaking of Miss Elders, calling her father... Good evening.
You spoke to him once.
He attracted my attention. He waved.
Hmm.
Boy, getting cooler every minute.
Yeah. What'd you start to say?
When?
Something about Miss Elders calling her father.
Oh, Miss Elders calling her father Professor reminds me of a silly new fad that's catching hold round town.
What's that?
Remember how irritated I got when Mr. Chinbunny received that fancy Ph.D. college degree and Frida commenced referring to him as the doctor?
Mm-hmm.
Other ladies are starting the stunt.
Referring to their husbands as the doctor?
No, not the doctor. Their own titles. For instance, Ms. Gulliver there on Mulberry Street's begun to call Raymond the superintendent. He's superintendent there in the streetcar barns, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Miss Donahue mentioned the engineer today.
Oh, sure.
I think that's silly, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, even Ruthie pulled off that... Good evening. What's eating him?
You wave again?
Yeah. Maybe he's waiting for you to speak.
I don't know him.
Well, speak anyway. Look how he's grinning and smirking. Go ahead and speak.
Evening.
Wonder why he sits in the porch swing that funny way, legs dangling over the end. Seems to me a professor that way.
Where do you teach?
Country school.
Do they call country school teachers professors?
I guess so.
Huh.
Oh, I was going to tell you about...
Listen.
Huh?
Listen.
Ah, that'll cool things off.
Oh, the wind is...
Wide open. Upstairs, pantry, hallway and all.
Hadn't I better go close them?
Oh, let's wait till the rain starts and then make a dash. I've always enjoyed doing that, ever since I was little.
Mm.
I figured out once why I enjoy waiting for the rain to start and then running to close the windows.
Mm-hmm.
When I was small, I used to be terrible scared of thunder and lightning. Probably because my mother was. It had come up a storm, and she just kept panic-stricken and cry and carry on right in front of Bess and I. Of course, that'd make us terrified, too. Well, the three of us would be trembling and apprehensive as a horse until the rain started, and that changed everything. Seemed like the rain took the curse off the thunder and lightning. Relieved us, don't you know? Instead of being miserable, we were all of a sudden happy. And we'd run to close the windows just laughing away.
Vic and Sade. That takes us back to the 1930s. Our guest is writer Sam Sinclair Baker. We're talking about radio as it was written in the 30s and 40s, and we'll get back to that subject right after this message from our sponsor.
There's a new member in the family. The Cromwell Savings Bank family, that is. And starting this Saturday, you'll find the same friendly and reliable service at the Cromwell Plaza office that's been in their family since 1871. You're invited to the grand opening this Saturday from 9 to noon. And if you decided to open a new savings account, now's the time to go to the Cromwell Plaza office. Right now, they're giving away a free coupon for a 5x7 Loring portrait for the $50 deposit, an 8x10 Loring portrait coupon for the $100 deposit, and a choice of three handsome decorator clocks for the deposit of $5,000 at the new Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office. Start your new savings bank account at Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office and know your family's finances are in good hands. They'll be open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 9 to noon. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office this Saturday for refreshments and your free gift. Open a new savings account and join the family. You'll be glad you did.
Sam, you were involved with famous jury trials. We were talking about that earlier, and the delightful Colonel Stupnagel program. What else did you do in radio?
Well, along the way, along with inflicting the public with a couple of thousand commercials, and again, on commercials, you know, you had you could build up a big scene which would fall flat on television today. But you can make anything happen in a commercial, and people listening would recreate it. One of the shows that I enjoyed doing very much, I did some scripts on for Dr. Christian, and I don't know, Gene Herschel was the star.
Sure, I remember that program.
Of Dr. Christian, and how things catch up with you. The newspapers almost every week have something on mercy killing, and there are the tremendous arguments going on about mercy killing, and I broke into Dr. Christian by seeing an item in a newspaper. A good tip for writers, look at your newspapers, look at your items, listen to your news on radio and watch on TV and so forth. And these little items can make a show. And I read a little bit about a mercy-killing case that was being tried and thought this would be a good Dr. Christian because you get the doctor involved. And I wrote it. They were having a big contest at the time, and I won the first prize. And now today, mercy-killing is hotter than ever, and I suppose they brought back that script. They repeated it at least three times that I know of.
Did you get paid all three times?
Yes. Sure, about $25 a script.
That was the show, if I'm not mistaken, where supposedly the listeners were invited to submit scripts.
Yes, that's right, and they had this big contest every year.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. the only show and, that did that.
Yeah, and you could be a professional writer, which I was at the time, but you had never written a Dr. Christian before. And then I wrote some Dr. Christian shows after that. And I I wonder if that's a prelude to being involved with doctors, because I've written eight books now with doctors.
That's right.
Dr. Stillman Dyer books, a book on skin problems with two dermatologists, a cosmetic surgery book with a plastic surgeon, Men's Health with a Dr. Guild up here in Harvard Medical School. And one thing leads to the other.
That's really something, isn't it?
Sam, when you were writing famous jury trials, Dr. Christian, and so on, were you totally involved with radio writing at that time, or were you also authoring books?
No, I was at that time. I was starting to write books. I was writing mystery stories for the magazines, and I started in mystery stories, and that led me more and more back into writing mysteries for radio, because I took a course with Dashiell Hammett, and Well, there's a great name in radio. Remember the fat man, the thin man?
Sam Spade, wasn't that?
And Sam Spade.
Yes.
And it was a very shocking thing to me. Hammett and I became, I wouldn't say friends, but acquaintances, and we'd go out after class and have a drink. And Hammett, this applies to my new book, Conscious Happiness, because you were asking me before whether people, if you have enough money, you're happy. But here was Hammett, and he was getting $2,000 a week for the rights on radio for each of those shows, The Thin Man, The Fat Man, and Sam Spade. So he told me, I'm making $6,000 a week. I'm not writing one word of those shows, just the rights. And he said, there's no point in getting up in the morning. I have no work to do. And poor Hammett became an alcoholic and all that. I'm not saying money is bad, but money certainly isn't the answer, which has taken us quite away from Dr. Christian, because I won the first prize at that time, which I think was $500. And imagine a contest today on radio. A person gets on a quiz show and walks away with $42,000 worth of refrigerators.
Sure. Well, some of the shows today could stand a good writing because the scripts are rather weak. But they've never seemed they discourage writers, don't they? Today, at least in TV, unless you're a part of the inner circle, you just don't have a chance to even submit
right.
scripts.
Right, and then even when you're in the inner circle, and I have refused to do. Television writing, because I like to write on my own, and you're part of a machine, because I have friends, directors and writers, and they say this is a machine operation. Now, I think the writing in radio for the dramatic shows and comedy and all was better than it is today. It wasn't as hard-boiled. It wasn't in such a format. You were allowed to take chances. Today, imagine I come to a television show and say I want to do a script on mercy killing. Whoa, wait a minute, let's get our 12 lawyers in here, and where do you base this, all that kind of thing. For no good reason, this reminds me of a very dramatic incident on famous jury trials. What we did was take a case that had actually happened, and there was a murder case that some of you may remember, the Titterton murder case. It was better known as the Beekman Place murder case. Nancy Titterton, a shy, not particularly attractive woman, I understand, I didn't know her, was strangled in her bathtub by an upholsterer's assistant who came in, and he strangled her with a cord of upholstery, an upholstery cord around her neck. She was married to Lewis Titterton, who was the head of the script division at National Broadcasting Company. And my wife, at the time, got a job at NBC, and she landed the job as secretary to Lewis Titterton. And meanwhile, I had written the Titterton murder, and it was about to go on the air in a couple of weeks. And I had to go pick up my wife and meet her new boss, Lewis Titterton. And I heard from a friend that Titterton knew I had written up this case. And he was very sensitive about it because he was suspected first of being the killer until they did track down. You know, they always think the husband is the killer. So I walked into the office, and my wife, he walked out of his office, and my wife said, oh, Mr. Titterton, I want you to meet my friend, Sam Baker. And Lewis Titterton had big glasses on, wild kind of hair. Became a good friend and a wonderful guy. And he came charging across the office, the light hitting his glasses and his hair flying and his hands outstretched. And I thought, oh, boy, I get strangled right here. And he came over, grabbed my hand, started pumping it, and said, glad to meet you. And he started turning away. And then he turned back and he said, I hear you wrote a very good script. And then dashed out of the office.
Well, I think that's reason enough to play a famous jury trials right here on the program, Ed.
All right, Dick, and you mentioned a lot of famous stars, and there is a very famous one here, Raymond Edwin Johnson, who was a resident of Wallingford.
Rich name.
Yes. And
voice, I mean, I can remember his voice. Next time you see Ray or talk with him, ask him about the times when he was either the prosecuting attorney or the defending attorney. Yeah, it's funny, a fellow would be one week and one the next week. Another thing you can do with radio, because they couldn't see that this is the same fellow last week was that iron-fisted prosecutor, and now he is pleading for the life of a defendant.
Yeah, you can wear two different hats and get away with it. And I think he's the prosecutor in this particular excerpt, by the way. So let's see what it sounds like, shall we?
O. Henry, America's famous candy bar, presents Famous Jury Trials.
Famous Jury Trials. Dramatizations in fictionized form of cases typical of many taken from actual court history. The dramatic story of our courts, where rich and poor alike, guilty and innocent, stand before the bar of justice.
Gentlemen of the jury, you are the judges of the evidence to be laid before you. Be just and fear not, for the true administration of justice is the foundation of good government.
People versus Anthony Lewis.
Tonight's famous jury trial is the sensational story of a brilliant young scientist's fight to clear himself of a charge of murder. The story began on a rainy afternoon in May several years ago in the rustic hamlet of Cottage Grove. It had been raining steadily all afternoon, and two young women had been marooned in the summer house of a picnic grove a few miles outside the village.
Mary, it's stopped now. We'd better hurry.
Okay. Oh, be careful of the puddles.
Oh,
yes. What time is it anyway?
Let's see. 5 to 4. Oh, I do hope that grocery boy had sense enough to leave the vegetables.
Mary, look. That parcel under the tree.
Well, what of it?
Well, look, Mary. The paper's bloody. There's like a hand sticking out of it.
Nearby, wrapped in dry newspaper, 6 similar parcels were found, containing the dismembered parts of 2 victims. These were presently identified as Mrs. Edwin Dexter and Anna McCoy, Mrs. Dexter's maid, both recently having disappeared. Mrs. Dexter was the young wife of the internationally famous biochemist, Dr. Edwin Dexter, chief of the Marshall Research Foundation in New York City. And then Dr. Anthony Lewis, Dr. Dexter's young assistant, was apprehended for the murder. Cool, handsome, in his early 30s, Dr. Lewis engaged the brilliant criminal lawyer, Samuel Llewellyn, to defend him, for Llewellyn had never lost a murder case. The keen eyes of Llewellyn were on the district attorney as he opened the case
and
for the people.
We will show, gentlemen of the jury, that deliberately, cold-bloodedly, with as little emotion as though he were dissecting a corpse in his laboratory, Dr. Anthony Lewis did plan and commit the murder of Mrs. Dexter. Call the first witness, Mrs. John Cotton.
John Cotton, take stand, please.
Mrs. Cotton described how she and her sister, caught in the picnic grove by a spring downpour, had found the dismembered bodies wrapped in newspaper. And the attorney for the defense cross-examined.
Just one question, Mrs. Cotton. Do you recall what time the rain stopped?
Yes, I do. It was at 4:05.
4:05 p.m.?
Yes.
Was that daylight or standard time?
Daylight time.
That's all. Thank you.
Call Dr. Sidney Green.
Sidney Green, thanks, Stan, please. I'm here, doctor. Raise your right hand, please. Solemnly swear the testimony about to give to be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth.
I do.
Dr. Green. You were Mrs. Dexter's personal physician?
Yes, sir, I was.
Had she an unusual bone condition for which you treated her?
Yes, sir. Bursitis, or a calcium condition in the right shoulder.
Is that a common condition?
No, not very common. Maybe 10 or 15 per 1,000 may have this ailment.
Now, you examined the dismembered remains?
Yes, sir, I did.
Tell the jury the condition you found in the right shoulder of the smaller victim.
There was a marked calcium deposit, such as characterizes a bursitis.
Thank you. That's all, Doctor. Cross-examine.
Doctor, do you yourself consider that this bursitis condition conclusively proves one of the victims to have been Jean Dexter?
Oh, no, definitely not.
That's all, thank you.
Call Dr. Edwin Ames Dexter.
Dr. Edwin Ames Dexter.
A stir ran through the tiny courtroom as Dr. Dexter came to the stand. He was a tall, distinguished-looking man in his late 40s. He testified.
I last saw my wife alive on the morning of May 4th. The day before the dismembered bodies were found near Cottage Grove.
Now, Doctor, on the morning of the 4th, your wife told you that she and her maid, Anna McCoy, were taking a trip to Cottage Grove?
Yes. She said the maid needed medical attention and that she was taking her to a hospital upstate.
And what did she say was the matter with the maid?
Well, Anna was in a condition commonly called in trouble. They naturally wanted as little scandal as possible.
Was your wife to have returned that night?
Yes. So, the next morning, when there was still no word, I phoned the hospital long distance.
And what did they tell you?
That my wife and Anna had never arrived at the hospital.
Now, Doctor, was your marriage a happy one?
It was, until recently.
And what had happened to change it?
My wife came to me one day and said she wanted a divorce. She said she was in love with my associate, Dr. Lewis.
I object. What his wife told him is not evidence. Overruled.
When was this conviction in relation to her disappearance?
Several weeks before.
And this divorce she asked for, did you agree to it?
I told her she could have a divorce at any time.
Did you question Dr. Lewis about his feelings?
Not directly. However, I did ask him casually one day if the date had been set for his wedding. And he said the last week in June. I therefore surmised that there was nothing to my wife's story.
Now, let us return to the morning of the 5th when your wife disappeared. Did Dr. Lewis come to the office that day?
No. Someone phoned saying that he was home ill.
Do you know whether he was, in fact, ill?
Hi, Dick. Overruled. Let him state if he knows.
No, sir. Dr. Lewis was not ill.
Did you see him yourself that day?
Yes. You see, after the hospital reported my wife had never been there, I drove to Cottage Grove myself to find out what was going on. And when I didn't find her, I concluded that my wife's disappearance and Dr. Lewis's not coming to work on the same day might be connected.
I moved to strike the doctor's conclusions out.
Yes, strike it out.
So you went to the defendant's home?
Well, I phoned Dr. Lewis first, but there was no answer. Then I went to his house and waited for him to come in.
Which was about
6:30. Well, Dr. Dexter, may I ask what you're doing in my apartment?
There are some questions I'd like to ask you, Doctor. Dr. Lewis, didn't you phone the office this morning and say you were ill?
Do I have to account for my time to you, Doctor?
Now, look here, Lewis, I'm worried. Jean's run away. Where is she?
How do I know where Jean is?
Didn't you go to Cottage Grove today?
It's none of your business.
I'm trying to be patient, Lewis. I know of Jean's feelings for you, and believe me, I don't blame you.
I give you my word, I don't know where she's gone.
Oh, don't you? Then what is this note from my wife doing on your desk?
You give me that note.
You may have it. I've read it. Now, will you tell me if you went to Cottage Grove this afternoon to meet her?
That's none of your business. Now, clear out of here, Doctor. I'm tired of your everlasting suspicions. Now, get out. Get out.
And that was all that happened, Dr. Dexter?
Yes.
Very well. Now, Doctor, I have here a portable typewriter. Mm-hmm. Can you identify it?
Yes, sir. It's my wife's. It was just overhauled. There's the repair shop stamp.
I offer this typewriter in evidence.
Let it be received and marked.
Do you recall when this typewriter was repaired?
Your Honor, Dex, this line of testimony is irrelevant.
Your Honor, my learned colleague will soon see where my line of questioning tends.
You may proceed. Objection overruled.
The typewriter was repaired the day before my wife disappeared.
Now tell me, Doctor, did your wife write all her correspondence on a typewriter?
Yes, she seldom wrote in longhand.
And when it was repaired, a new ribbon was installed in this particular machine?
Yes.
Now, is it not true that if certain chemicals are applied to a new typewriter ribbon, the typing becomes legible?
Yes. A weak acid solution applied to a new ribbon will so discolor that ribbon that one can read what has been written on it.
As a chemist, you know this, Doctor.
Yes.
And did you try the experiment?
I did.
Is this the ribbon you took off that machine?
Yes.
I asked this typewriter ribbon be marked in evidence.
Let it be received and marked.
Will you please read the message on it?
It reads, Tony, I can't go on anymore. I must see you. Can you meet me tomorrow at the Proctor Inn near the Grove, where we have spent so many happy hours? Don't fail me, dear. I need you so.
What did you do after reading this on the ribbon?
I went to the police and reported my wife and Anna missing.
Famous jury trials from the collection of Ed Corcoran. Our guest tonight, Sam Sinclair Baker, and we'll get back to our topic of radio writing right after this message.
Cromwell Savings Bank announces the grand opening of the Cromwell Plaza office this Saturday, 9 to noon, with giveaways for all new savings accounts. For a $50 deposit, they'll give you a coupon for a beautiful 5x7 Loring portrait of someone you love, or deposit $100 for an 8x10 portrait coupon. And when you deposit $5,000 in your new savings account at Cromwell Plaza, they'll give you your choice of an authentic 20-inch reproduction of the classic grandfather clock, a colonial decorator wall clock, or a handsome contemporary wall clock. Isn't it time you put your family's finances in the hands of a reliable savings bank? Start your new savings account at the new Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office, where you'll be given personal attention on all your banking needs. They'll be open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and, for your convenience, Saturdays, 9 to 12 noon. Remember to stop by this Saturday between 9 and noon for the grand opening of the Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office near Kmart in Cromwell. Refreshments and gifts will be given to all visitors.
Sam Sinclair Baker is one of America's most noted writers, certainly one of America's most prolific writers, Sam having written well over 20 books. And we're talking about his early career in the days of radio. And I understand that you were involved with several gangbusters programs.
Yes, there again, I it was hard to bust into gangbusters. It was the top rated show and a very, very good show. But I got an idea, I don't remember at the moment, just what it was. It was something, again, that was way out. Oh, it was a peculiar kind of a prison break. And all you need is that one idea, and then you work it into a script. And I wrote the script, and I just found the name of someone who was buying scripts at Gangbusters and sent it to him. And people said to me, oh, you'll never, they never look at scripts from the outside. I got a phone call a few weeks later and said, we're buying your script. Give us more. So then I wrote a number more, and you start from the, you fit into a format, but you have all this leeway of all kinds of approaches that work.
Yeah, essentially, you get a rough outline. We talked to one of the men who did the research when they were early guests, Dick, remember, from the Aetna?
Yes, I do.
And in fact, he even said he never sits in a restaurant with his back to the door because of his Gangbusters experience.
Yeah, it was the kernels of it were based on a real-life case.
Yes.
And you know what you had to be careful about? Using the things that happened exactly, not because you weren't permitted to, because you changed the names, but so many things happened in real life that people just wouldn't believe. This was true in Gangbusters and jury trials and all. They wouldn't believe the stupid things criminals did, for example. So you had to make the criminal a little smarter than he actually was.
Yeah, we got caught. He wasn't too smart, right? That's the premise you have to have.
Oh, yeah, and they better all get caught, too.
That's right.
Or else
that's
the
one
show
thing
wouldn't
about
get on the air.
Radio and early film was the morality was always there. Nobody got away with anything. There was always a day of retribution at the end, wasn't there?
Right, and this didn't seem to matter because while the listener always knew that the guilty one was going to be punished and caught, you had to work it so that right up to the last minute you stopped and you had your last commercial and then you came on with the bang and the listener knew what was going to happen, and yet the surprise was there.
Oh, sure.
And a big part of it was because he had built this all up in his own mind.
Well, the thing about Gangbusters, I think, was the dialogue. I always thought it was very brilliant for its show. It's sort of a little like Kojak today. I think the dialogue is more advanced than most police shows, and I think Gangbusters were the same way. They really caught the flavor of the underworld, really, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and as in most things, it went back to one man, I think, Phillips Lord, who was the producer, director. He conceived the show, as I recall, and he let the writer really write in a salty, brisk, different kind of way whenever he wanted to.
Well, on that show, did you work with, as we were talking earlier, researchers, people who would actually dig up the facts for you?
I was different in that I started by digging up my own facts.
Uh-huh.
And then after a while, they did give me a few just background things, and you followed that for the format. And then I would go to the newspaper morgues and fill in with a lot of clippings and so forth.
Yeah.
Which helped a great deal.
Were you called in, Sam, for any rehearsals for perhaps the need of reworking a scene at the last minute? Did that ever happen?
Yes, this happened all the time. We mentioned before Roger Bauer, who is lives not far from here in Connecticut, and Roger was the director, and he was really a tough cookie and known as the toughest of the directors. And the first famous jury trials we did, we had been doing it 3/4 of an hour from Cincinnati, and then decided to do it from New York, and it had to be cut to a half hour. So the first one that we were doing was really a sort of a pilot. And he had all his cast in there, and I came into the studio, and radio, you worked very fast. He had gotten the script the day before, he had lined it up and so forth, and they had a run through. And I walked into the studio and heard Roger saying in a very colorful voice, with very this so-and-so writer, the show runs 35 minutes. And he's screaming at them. Meanwhile, I walked into another room, grabbed the script, and started working. And he went on for about 10 minutes. What am I going to do with these writers? This stupid so-and-so is an advertising agency man to start with. And he's also the agency producer on the show and whatnot. And I walked in, I tapped him on the arm in mid-voice, and he turned to me and says, "What are you on?" And I said, "I'm Sam Baker." He says, "What do I care?" And I said, "I'm the writer." And he looked at me in utter disgust, and he says, "Do you realize that this damn script is 5 minutes too long?" And I hand him the paper, and I said, "Here are your cuts." And he was open-mouthed, and he said to somebody, "Time this." And he went through the script, and he read the cuts. It came to 5 minutes precisely. And he looked at me, and he shook hands. He says, "We're going to be friends."
That's a great story. Well, with that as a background, suppose we turn to Gangbusters.
Okay, Dick, and maybe this will illustrate this dialogue I was referring to. And it features Ken Lynch, who you may see.
I saw him on the on our programs very often.
Very good heavy, and he's a heavy here, and he's on the McLeod series on TV.
He is.
Yes, he's a regular on there. And he plays the part of Robbie. And I think you'll find this quite interesting. Bill Smith is in here, too, who does he does dubs for foreign films, so those are familiar
voices.
He
has a lot of
you.
Voices, hasn't he,
yes.
Bill Smith? Sure.
So here is that sparkling dialogue of Gangbusters, Dick.
And now Gangbusters presents the case of the Sledgehammer Handicap, in which a hot horse, an open drawbridge, a phone call from a locked and bolted drugstore, and a woman's way parlay each other into days of dangerous determination for New Orleans detectives.
Gangbusters, the only national program to bring you authentic police case history. Tonight, Gangbusters has asked the Honorable Joseph Charing, Superintendent of Police, New Orleans, Louisiana, to narrate by proxy the case of the Sledgehammer Handicap. Superintendent Charing.
Thank you. And good evening, Gangbusters listeners. Suppose we begin tonight's case in the old quarter of New Orleans, one morning last winter. A man about 30 hurriedly entered the downstairs door of a rundown apartment house and ran breathlessly up two stairs at a time toward the dimly lit second floor hall.
Fran! Where are you, Fran?
Quiet, will you?
Hey, did you hear what, Fran? Robbie got out. They had him waking in the fields. He ducked in a sugar cane away from the guards and jumped in the river. He swam downstream a couple of miles. I just heard it on the radio.
I know,
yeah, the last thing they found, you know. How do you know? It was just on the radio just now.
Robbie's in there shaving.
You're kidding.
Wish I was. He walked in just after you left.
Hey, Fran, this is no place for me. I better get going.
You stick around.
No, but Fran, you...
You're a friend of his, aren't you?
Yeah, but if Robbie ever gets an idea what's been going on between you and me, oh, brother.
Who expected him to escape?
Listen, don't say a word. I've been here, Fran. I'll just say goodbye. It's been nice and lots of luck.
You'll stick around. Robbie's been asking for you.
He has?
I told him you were coming back.
Oh, Fran.
Don't off-Fran me. I don't want him around. It was all over when he went away, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, but what about as far as he was concerned?
Everything will be all right. Did you get a scratch sheet?
Oh, how can you think about horses at a time like this? How long's it take him to shave, anyway?
Did you bring back a scratch sheet?
Yeah, I brought a scratch sheet. Here's your rotten scratch sheet. I...
Hello, Leo.
Oh, Robbie. Hi.
Thought I heard your voice. Come here, Leo.
Fran was telling me, Robbie.
Come in here, Leo. I want to talk to you.
He can wait until you finish shaving.
I said come in here.
Yeah. I'm sure glad you made it, Robbie.
I knew you would be. Fran, get me some coffee ready when I'm finished.
Coffee?
Yeah, go on, coffee.
Boy, you can imagine my surprise, Robbie.
You didn't think I was going to wait around in there for the whole 10 years, did you?
No, but I hear that ain't such an easy place to crack out of, Angola.
It isn't.
What are you counting on doing?
What did you say?
I said, what are you counting on doing? You know, I was just wondering.
What brings you around here so early?
Why, nothing, Robbie. I just picked up a scratch sheet. Me and Fran usually go over the horses together.
So she's still a horse player?
Yeah, me too.
How you doing?
Well, you know how it is, Robbie. You win one day, you blow it the next.
I don't mean with the horses. I mean with Fran.
Hey, now, Robbie, you got the wrong slant. There's nothing between me and Fran.
No?
No, I'll take a note on it. We're just a couple of friendly horse players.
A lot of stories come drifting back to me up there.
No, you got my word for it, Robbie.
Like, I don't like to be sitting alone up there and hear those kind of stories.
Now, Robbie, listen to me.
Listen to me. You can have her.
I can?
I took one look at her, and you can have her.
I wouldn't want to do you out of anything. You know me.
I told you can have her.
That's awful nice of you.
I consider you doing me a favor, Leo. It's settled.
Yeah. Maybe I ought to go out and tell Fran there's nothing to worry about.
Now, wait a minute.
Well, she's entitled to stop worrying.
Let her worry about something else besides the horses for a few days. It'll do her good.
Yeah, but Robbie, you...
Stick here. I'll talk to you some more.
Oh. About what?
You been working lately?
You mean working or working?
You know what I mean.
No, Robbie, not much.
All right, Leo. You work with me. We're a team.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's settled.
Captain Juliet.
Oh, Captain, I was able to locate Detective Paul Poisonhole. He's right here now.
Good, good. Ask him to step in.
Yes, sir. Go right in, Paul.
Ann Baker.
Yes, sir.
Call the Bureau of Identification. I want some more recent pictures of Robbie Bertram.
Yes, Captain.
Come over. Sit down, Paul.
Sure, Captain.
Listen, Baker.
Yes, sir.
The most recent picture identification sent down was made in 1944 when he was arrested on the last offense. Ask them to check the penitentiary. Maybe they've got something made later.
Yes, Captain.
Okay, get on it. Well, Paul, I suppose you heard the news.
You mean about Robbie Bertram, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard it. He figured to break out sooner or later, Captain. Robbie was always a hard boy to hold down.
You think you can find him?
He's in New Orleans, maybe.
Well, if he is, we can expect to break out all over in safe burglaries.
They're telling me, like a plague.
I've got our old reports out on... It says here he used to go with a girl, an inveterate horse player.
That's right, Fran something.
Liggett, Fran Liggett.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I want you to locate her, Paul. If you do, you'll probably locate Robbie.
Fran! Fran, come here, Fran.
Oh, Leo.
Gee, where you been, Fran?
If a person wins on a horse, they're entitled to collect the bet, aren't they?
What, did that 10-1 shot win it?
He did, and he closed at 12-1.
I know I should have laid in a bet.
I told you, didn't I? Well, aren't you going to invite a lady to sit down?
Yeah, sit down.
Much obliged.
Why, I can't get up nerve enough to go in on them good things. I'll never know. All the dogs I got a bet on.
It's technique, that's all. A system. Where's Robbie?
I got to meet him.
Oh, well, then let's go.
No, Fran, you better stay here. You see, this is the big deal. We're going to look over that safe we got to rip open tonight, you know?
What's the matter with me going? I used to go, you know?
Yeah, I know. But Robbie thinks it's better to be careful.
How careful can he get? He sees you, don't he?
Well, Robbie and me are working together.
You'd think I was poisoned.
All right, Fran, baby. I don't know. I guess it's all right to let you in on it now.
Let me in on what?
Robbie knows all about us.
He does?
I didn't tell him. He heard it in the penitentiary.
Uh-oh.
I was scared to death, baby, and then he tells me it's okay with him. He don't care.
He don't?
We got his blessings.
What? Well, that's a lot of nerve.
I think it's good. It's wonderful, baby. Suppose he was mad. Look what he'd do to the both of us.
I never heard of such a thing.
What do you mean you never heard of such a thing? It worked out fine.
That's no way to treat a lady.
Listen, I thought I was the one you wanted.
That's so, but the least he could do would be to make an effort.
Oh, Fran, what are you complaining about?
Oh, nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, for crying out loud, you don't have to get mad at me.
Who's mad at you?
Frankly, this whole thing's got me puzzled. Listen, we talk about it later. I gotta go and meet Robbie.
Well, go meet him. Who's stopping you?
Honest to goodness,
Go on. I got plenty to do. I got to dope out tomorrow's horses.
Okay, honey. I'll see you later.
Taxicabs.
I want a cab.
Yes, sir. Where at?
Corner of Mirabeau and Paris in front of the drugstore.
Yes, sir. The corner of Mirabeau and Paris in front of the drugstore. Right away. Thank you, sir.
I'll mention it.
Come on, Robbie. Let's go.
All right, Leo. Take your time. But
my time. We break into a drugstore. We knock open the safe. We make enough racket to bring the house down at 2 a.m. We got the dough. We're ready to go, and you want to make a phone call. Can't you make your phone calls from someplace else? From home, for instance?
Relax. I was calling a taxi.
A taxi?
What do you want to do, take a streetcar?
Robbie, for crying out loud, we just been into the safe here, remember?
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. I want to get out of here. I got the tools already. Let's go.
Leave the tools lay.
Leave them lay? Where are we going to get another extension, Jimmy, like that one?
We'll get it. Leave the tools lay. You want to get picked up with tools on you? Okay. Out the way we came.
I don't have to be coaxed. Let's go.
Gangbusters. Oh, that was a great series. We'll get back to our guest, Sam Sinclair Baker, right after this message.
There's a new member in the family, the Cromwell Savings Bank family, that is. And starting this Saturday, you'll find the same friendly and reliable service at the Cromwell Plaza office that's been in their family since 1871. You're invited to the grand opening this Saturday from 9 to noon, and if you've decided to open a new savings account, now's the time to go to the Cromwell Plaza office. Right now, they're giving away a free coupon for a 5x7 Loring portrait for the $50 deposit, an 8x10 Loring portrait of coupon for the $100 deposit, and a choice of 3 handsome decorator clocks for the deposit of $5,000 at the new Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office. Start your new savings account at Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office and know your family's finances are in good hands. They'll be open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 9 to noon. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank's Plaza office this Saturday for refreshments and your free gift. Open a new savings account and join the family. You'll be glad you did.
Sam Sinclair Baker has been our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And Sam, I do want to thank you for sharing some of these delightful stories with you. You never went into television, did you?
Yes, I did some television.
You did?
Yeah. Before we leave radio, though, there was one show that I used to enjoy very much, and I never wrote for it, but it was 21st Precinct.
Oh, I remember.
And I remember
that
one
show.
Of the stars of that was Everett Sloan.
Sure.
And we used to use Everett Sloan on jury trials and other shows, again, whenever we wanted a screamer. Yeah. You're killing me, stop! And so forth. That was a beautiful show, too.
It was, and he was a great actor. Sam, thank you so much for being with us here on the Golden Age of Radio and bringing these years back to life for us.
I enjoyed it tremendously.
And now, until next time, this is Dick Pertell.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell and near Kmart at the new Plaza office. A friendly bank in a friendly town. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertell.
Rinso white and rinso bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day.